This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Four games this week in the Week 11 edition of the Historically Speaking NFL Matchup episode, and all four of them are memorable games from the archives of the National Football League. And hello, once again, sports fans. I'm Dana Augusta, your host, as we go back and take a look at some of the games on the schedule this weekend that are rematches of memorable games from NFL history. And this week, we will relive four games that have special places in the world of pro football history. First, we'll talk about what was not aesthetically a great game, but maybe considered one of the most important games in the history of the league and offered legitimacy to the impending merger between the AFL and the NFL. We will also take a look back at the second coldest game in NFL history, which was an AFC Championship game between two upstart teams in the early 1980s. Then there were another postseason game between two league heavyweights in the AFC Divisional Playoffs in the mid-70s that sports writers at the time dubbed Super Bowl 8.5. And it truly lived up to the hype and is considered one of the greatest games in NFL postseason history. Then there's the matchup this weekend between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Buffalo Bills, which evokes memories of that divisional playoff game a few years ago, i.e. 13 seconds, and also those matchups that highlighted the decade of the 1990s. Yet the game that we'll talk about is their first ever postseason matchup between the Chiefs and the Bills, with no less than a berth in the first ever Super Bowl on the line, as the Bills were the two-time defending AFL champions themselves looking for a three-peat. So that is what we have going on here in this Week 11 edition of the Historically Speaking NFL Matchups edition here on the Sports History Network, where we give you the best of sports from back in the day. There are games that take place where we look back on them and we could say, for good or sometimes bad, changed the course of history for that league. One such game took place in Miami on January 12, 1969, as the New York Jets faced the Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. Now, I'm sure most of you that tune in to this podcast and other sports history podcasts know the story. The Jets, champions of the upstart American Football League, had defeated the Oakland Raiders in the AFL Championship game at Shea Stadium, who were soundly defeated by the Green Bay Packers the year before in Super Bowl II. Not to mention, those very same Packers had their way with the Kansas City Chiefs in the inaugural Super Bowl in Los Angeles in January of 1967. More on those Chiefs later in this episode. Anyway, the Jets' opponents in that game were the Baltimore Colts, who blazed through the NFL that season with a 13-1 record, led by head coach Don Shula and quarterback Earl Morrall, who replaced John Unitas for most of, if not the entire season, after Unitas had injured his elbow in preseason. The NFL Championship game, the Colts avenged their only loss that year with a 34-0 trouncing of the Browns at Cleveland Municipal Stadium. And the Colts' win was so impressive that, according to most experts, Baltimore was installed as a 19.5-point favorite to beat New York. And, of course, you know what happens next. During Super Bowl week, Joe Namath and the Jets quarterback guaranteed that his team, despite being 19.5-point underdogs, will beat the Colts. So the stage was set in what ultimately would be the biggest upset in Super Bowl history, as well as one of the most important games in the history of pro football. In the first quarter, the Jets punted on their first drive, and the Colts started off quickly with passes by Morrow and runs by backs Jerry Hill and Tom Maddie. And with the ball on the Jets' 19-yard line, Morrow would throw two incompletions and then would be sacked by Jets linebacker Al Atkinson. On fourth down, Colts kicker Lou Michaels would miss a 27-yard field goal as the Jets would get the ball back. At the end of the quarter, the Colts would have another chance as Colts DB Lenny Lyles forced a George Sauer fumble and Ron Porter recovered it on the Jets' 12. On the second play of the second quarter, Morrow would throw his first of what would be three interceptions on the day, victimized by Randy Beverly in the end zone. The Jets would take full advantage of the Colts' turnover as they would drive 80 yards on 12 plays, culminating with a 4-yard touchdown run by Matt Snell. However, late in the second quarter, a play that would haunt the Colts for years to come occurred and became one of the most famous plays in the early years of the Super Bowl. Baltimore tried a flea flicker play. Morrow handed the ball to Tom Maddie on a sweep to the right, then turned and threw the ball back to Morrow. The play completely fooled not only the Jets' defense, but the NBC camera crew as well. Wide receiver Jimmy Orr was completely uncovered and just steps from the end zone, but Morrow missed him and threw the ball instead to fullback Jerry Hill, which was intercepted by Jets defensive back Jim Hudson. After the near fireworks, the Jets and Colts went back into the locker room with New York holding a 7-0 lead. The Jets would add a pair of Jim Turner field goals to make the score 13-0 as the game went into the fourth quarter. And with the time running out on the Colts, Shula decided he could wait no longer and inserted Unitas into the game. Now, with the Jets relying on their running game, they kept the Colts defense on the field and Unitas off of it. In the first drive of the final period, the Jets had a chance to really put the game away. Aided by a 39-yard pass to George Sauer, the Jets drove to the Colts' 2-yard line but could not get any closer. Jim Turner came on for a 9-yard field goal to make the score 16-0 with 13 minutes remaining. On Baltimore's next possession, he managed to drive the ball all the way to the Jets' 25. However, Randy Beverly, once again, who intercepted Morrow in the second quarter, ended the drive by intercepting a Unitas pass intended for Orr in the end zone. It was the Jets' fourth interception of the game, which was also Beverly's second in the game. The Colts, led by Unitas, were now looking just to get on the scoreboard. After completing a crucial fourth down pass to Jimmy Orr, the Colts' offense finally got into rhythm and drove to the Jets' 1. From there, Jerry Hill would plow into the end zone for Baltimore's first and only touchdown of the game. And even though the Colts would recover an onside kick on the ensuing kickoff, they wouldn't get any closer as the Jets pulled off the biggest upset in Super Bowl history, capturing their first and only Super Bowl championship, winning 16-7. Despite being named Game Most Valuable Player, Jets quarterback Joe Namath had sort of a pedestrian day in the passing department, going 17 of 28 for 206 yards and no touchdowns. Yet the key players for the drive was, the key players for the Jets, I should say, was fullback Matt Snell, who carried the ball 30 times for 121 yards and one touchdown. And receiver George Sauer, who came up big as Jets Hall of Fame wide receiver Don Maynard was hampered with a hamstring injury. Sauer had 8 catches for 133 yards. Meanwhile, the Colts had an afternoon they most want to forget. Most notably, Earl Morrow did, who led the Colts to 14 wins in 15 games in 1968. Had a game he most want to forget, going 6 of 17 for just 71 yards and 3 picks, and a passer rating of 9.3. after a couple, here is a couple of interesting nuggets that came from this game. This was the last postseason win for the Jets until they defeated the Cincinnati Bengals on January 9th, 1983, nearly 14 years to the day later. They beat Cincinnati by a score of 44-17 at Riverfront Stadium. Also, during the calendar year of 1969, this would be the first of three instances where a team from New York would defeat a team from Baltimore in postseason play. After the Jets defeated the Colts, the New York Knicks would beat the then Baltimore Bullets in the 1969 NBA playoffs, while that October, the Miracle Mets would beat the heavily favored Orioles in the World Series. On January 10th, 1982, the first ever playoff meeting between the San Diego Chargers and the Cincinnati Bengals was historic, to say the least. Not only was this the first ever meeting between the Chargers and the Bengals in the playoffs, but the week before, both teams were involved in memorable close games. The Bengals, thanks to a fourth down stop against the Buffalo Bills, claimed their first postseason win in team history, beating the Bills 28-21. Meanwhile, the Chargers, despite blowing a 24-point first quarter lead, defeated the Miami Dolphins in a game known as the Epic in Miami, 41-38, as both teams set numerous postseason offensive scoring records. For the Chargers, it was their second consecutive trip to the AFC Championship game, losing the year before to eventual Super Bowl champion Oakland Raiders. Looking at it from the Chargers' perspective for a second, this would be a tale of two extremes. In their divisional round win, San Diego not only had to deal with the Don Shula-coached Miami Dolphins, but the heat and humidity of the Miami Orange Bowl. Game time temperature was a sticky 88 degrees with high humidity. So high, in fact, several Chargers, including tight end Kellen Winslow, suffered from extreme cramping during the game. The following week, the Chargers went from hot house to ice house. In the second coldest game in terms of air temperature in NFL history, Air Coryell had to navigate the Arctic-type conditions to reach Super Bowl 16 in Pontiac, Michigan. Air temperature was minus 9 degrees. However, if you factor in sustained winds of 27 miles per hour during the course of the game, the wind chill plummeted to an NFL record low, minus 59 degrees. The game would go down in NFL lore as the Freezer Bowl. And from the start, this game would be unusual, as this would be one of the few times in NFL history where the same team kicked off to begin both halves. The Bengals won the toss, and instead of receiving, Bengals coach Forrest Gregg elected to have the wind at their backs to start the game, believing that the frigid swirling winds would neutralize the Chargers' offense. And in the beginning of the game, the strategy seemed to pay off, as the Chargers' offense struggled to get going. Meanwhile, Cincinnati got going behind quarterback Ken Anderson. The key play of their opening drive was an 18-yard completion to tight end Dan Ross. That led to a 31-yard field goal by kicker Jim Breach. On the ensuing kickoff, Bengals linebacker Rick Rosano knocked the ball loose from San Diego rookie returner and future Bengal James Brooks, and Don Bass recovered it on the Charger 12. From there, Anderson completed an 8-yard touchdown pass to ML Harris to extend their lead to 10-0. In the second quarter, San Diego got back into the game and scored their lone touchdown of the game when Dan Fouts connected with tight end Kellen Winslow on a 33-yard touchdown pass to cut the Bengals' lead to 10-7. And it seemed like the Chargers had the momentum, but the Bolts would not get any closer. On the ensuing kickoff, Bengals returner David Verser brought it back 40 yards to the 46-yard line. Now, working with a short field, the Bengals and Anderson went right back to work. A key play in that drive, while facing a 3rd-and-7, Anderson completed a 16-yard pass to Isaac Curtis, bringing the ball to the Chargers 1. From there, Pete Johnson blasted his way across the goal line to make the score 17-7 as both teams went into the locker room for halftime. The second half totally belonged to the Bengals as the sub-zero temperatures and the stingy Bengals defense were beginning to take its toll on Air Coryell. The Bengals defense, led by linebacker Reggie Williams and defensive back Ross Browner, limited the NFL's highest scoring offense to only 7 points for the game and completely shut them out in the second half. Breach would add another field goal in the third quarter. Then in the fourth, the Bengals put the game away thanks to a 14-play scoring drive, which culminated with a 3-yard touchdown pass to Don Bass, punching the Bengals' ticket to their first Super Bowl in franchise history, winning 27-7. This was not only a historic day for the Cincinnati Bengals, but also for his head coach, Forrest Gregg. Gregg not only coached in one of the coldest games in NFL history, but he also played in another, as he was the starting offensive lineman for the Green Bay Packers in the famed Ice Bowl, the 1967 NFL Championship game. Also with the win, Gregg became the first person to have both played and coached in a Super Bowl. The Bengals, however, would go on to lose to the San Francisco 49ers in Super Bowl 16, 26-21. There are few playoff games in NFL history that the game actually surpassed the hype. On December 21, 1974, the Miami Dolphins, the two-time defending Super Bowl champions, traveled to the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum to face the Raiders in the AFC Divisional Playoffs. This matchup caught the eye of Sports Illustrated, which proclaimed this game Super Bowl 8.5. But for many others, they considered this one of the greatest games in NFL history. The Dolphins were led, of course, by head coach Don Shula, and the offensive stars of Bob Greasy at quarterback and running back Larry Zonka and wide receiver Paul Warfield. The Dolphins had defeated the Raiders in the AFC Championship game the year before and were looking to appear in their fourth straight Super Bowl. And in the beginning moments of the game, it certainly looked like they were well on their way. On the opening kickoff, Dolphins rookie wide receiver Nat Moore returned it 89 yards for a touchdown to give Miami an early lead. Raider fortune seemed to go from bad to worse as quarterback Ken Stabler would be intercepted by Miami safety Dick Anderson on their opening drive. Yet on the play, his no-name defense teammate and MVP of Super Bowl VII, Jake Scott, was injured and would miss the remainder of the game. In the second quarter, the Raiders would finally find the end zone, as Stabler would connect with running back Charlie Smith for a 31-yard touchdown to tie the score at 7. Yet right before the half, Miami would retake the lead with a 33-yard field goal by Yarrow Yepremian. And at the start of the second half, the Raiders found their offensive rhythm and scored on a 13-yard touchdown pass to fellow Hall of Famer Fred Biletnikoff to give the Raiders a 14-10 score. On the next Dolphins drive, they would take full advantage of a 29-yard pass interference penalty on a third down, which immediately led to a 16-yard touchdown pass from Bob Greasy to Paul Warfield. Your premium's extra point attempt was blocked by Bubba Smith. Yeah, that Bubba Smith, which was the anchor of the great Baltimore Colts defense in the late 60s and early 70s, now with the Raiders. With the missed extra point, the Dolphins led by only 2, 16-14 as the game headed into the fourth quarter. In the fourth, Miami increased its lead with another field goal, making it 19-14. Midway in the fourth, Stabler called for the Raiders' most famous weapon, the bomb. With the ball on their own 28-yard line, Stabler threw deep down the near sideline for receiver Cliff Branch. Branch eluded a pair of Dolphin defensive backs making a diving catch. But before the Miami defenders could touch him down, Branch got up and sprinted the rest of the way for a 72-yard touchdown to give the Raiders a 21-19 lead late in the game. But the fireworks were far from over. On the next Dolphin possession, Miami went to their ground game. And with 2:08 remaining in the game, Dolphins running back Benny Malone in the game, who replaced an injured Mercury Morris, evaded 4 Raider tackle attempts and rumbled 23 yards for a touchdown to give the Dolphins the lead again 26-21. And with 2 minutes left, the Raiders retained possession on their own 32-yard line. And with all their timeouts remaining, the Raiders began their final drive. After a 6-yard completion to Bob Moore and a short run, Stabler completed a pair of completions to Fred Biletnikoff of 18 and 20 yards respectively. 2 more completions to Branch and Frank Pitts placed the ball on the Dolphin 14-yard line. From there, a 6-yard carry by Clarence Davis placed the ball on the 8-yard line where the Raiders called their final timeout. On the next play, Stabler dropped back to pass and looked for Biletnikoff in the end zone, but he was tightly covered. With Dolphins defensive end Vern Denherter dragging him down, Stabler threw a desperate pass to the left side of the end zone into a sea of hands, where Clarence Davis fought his way through the Dolphin defenders to make the touchdown catch. With the extra point, the Raiders regained the lead 28-26 with 24 seconds remaining. And this type of game that featured 2 elite teams, anything seemed possible with little time remaining. But the Dolphins' second offensive play, Miami's hopes for a third straight Super Bowl championship evaporated, as Bob Greasy's pass was intercepted by Raider linebacker Phil Villapiano on the Raiders' 45-yard line to clinch the game. "This has to be the toughest loss I've ever suffered," said Miami coach Don Shula. "The Raiders are a great credit to pro football," he added. "They needed touchdowns to win, and they got them." Stabler finished the game with 20 of 30 for 294 yards and 4 touchdowns in the 2-point win. Biletnikoff caught 8 passes for 122 yards and a touchdown. And even though the Raiders would lose the following week in the AFC Championship game to the Pittsburgh Steelers, Oakland's win in the Sea of Hands game made them one of the elite teams in the decade of the 1970s. And is remembered for all time as one of the greatest games in NFL postseason history. On January 1st, 1967, the same day as the classic NFL championship game between the Cowboys and the Packers in the Cotton Bowl, the Kansas City Chiefs traveled to Buffalo's War Memorial Stadium to take on the 2-time defending American Football League champion Buffalo Bills for the right to face those same Packers in Super Bowl I 2 weeks later in Los Angeles. The Kansas City Chiefs came of that game champions of the AFL's Western Division with an 11-2-1 record, facing the Bills, Eastern Division champs, who were 9-4-1 on the season. And despite the Bills playing at home, the Chiefs were a 3-point favorite, mostly because of the Chiefs' explosive and innovative offense led by head coach Hank Stram and quarterback Lynn Dawson. Meanwhile, the Bills were an old-school smash-mouth team that was dependent on their defense, solid running game, and the toughness of their scrappy but resourceful quarterback Jack Kemp. This was the third meeting between these two teams during the season, as they split the 2 matchups that took place early in the season where weather was not a factor. However, this game in Western New York was played in a cold, chilly drizzle. Early on, it seemed like the Bills had their problems from the start as they fumbled the opening kickoff and Jarrell Wilson recovered it for the Chiefs on the Buffalo 31-yard line. This led to the first score of the game, as Lynn Dawson connected with tight end Fred Arbanas on a 29-yard touchdown pass to give Kansas City an early 7-0 lead. Late in the first quarter, the Bills were tied to score as quarterback Jack Kemp connected with Albert Dubinion, who beat Chiefs defensive back Fred the Hammer Williamson and raced 69 yards for a touchdown, tying the score at 7 apiece. In the second quarter, Chiefs would retake the lead as Dawson would connect with All-AFL receiver Otis Taylor for a 29-yard touchdown pass to give Kansas City a 14-7 advantage. Buffalo would drive on their next possession all the way to the Kansas City 12, looking to tie the game at 14. But Chiefs defensive back Johnny Robinson had other ideas. On a play that would change the course of the game, Kemp threw the ball into the end zone and was intercepted by Robinson and returned it 72 yards to the Bills 28. And then from there, Mike Mercer would connect on a 32-yard field goal to extend the Chiefs' lead to 17-7 at halftime. After a scoreless third quarter, the Chiefs put the game away and punched their ticket to the first Super Bowl. Early in the final period, Kansas City Chiefs back Mike Garrett would score his first of two touchdowns of the period, a one-yard touchdown to make the score 24-7. Then, after a Bills turnover, the signature play of the game. With the ball on the Buffalo 18-yard line, Dawson pitched the ball to Garrett on a halfback option pass. The Buffalo rush made Garrett tuck the ball and run to the other side of the field, and after eluding several Bills defenders, Garrett scored his second touchdown of the afternoon to put the game away 31-7, winning their second AFL championship and their first as the Kansas City Chiefs. Their only other AFL title came in 1962, then known as the Dallas Texans. Dawson finished the game with 227 yards passing and two touchdowns, going 6 of 24 in the air. The Chiefs were going to face the Packers in the Super Bowl, yet would lose to Lombardi and crew 35-10 in LA just 2 weeks later. And that will do it for the Week 11 edition of the Historically Speaking NFL Matchups mini episode. Please, guys, thank you again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe. We'll try to come out with these NFL historical matchup episodes every week during the NFL regular season, highlighting great and memorable games from the long history of the National Football League. And as usual, this podcast comes to you from the Bill King Memorial Studio in the Sports Wing of TM4 Enterprises, located in suburban Atlanta in the shadow of Stone Mountain. To get more content of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, you can check us out on Twitter at HistoricallySP2, or you can send us a line at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And if you have not done so already, once again, please subscribe to the show. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, hell, tell her passerby on the street about us if you think they like sports history. And until the next episode, stay blessed, stay cool, and be your best in everything that you do. It will make the world a much, much better place. Thanks, and see you later.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.